Cheapest watch in the room says it's a couple of seconds after 9:30. So I propose that we commence. Eddie, is it one of your cell phones with this funny tune again? Switch it off, Eddie. Put it on silent. It should have a silent feature. Chairperson, welcome.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad I found you and I counted
it. Yes. Welcome, ma'am. I was saying to your colleague, I had earlier asked, where's the delegation from the IEC? And he reminded me that he's part of the delegation, and I did say to him that I'm used to the roses of the IEC, not the thorns. But welcome, ma'am. And I also told them that the cheapest watch in the room just said it's now 1 minute shy of 9:30. So we had just started the meeting when you walked in. So you are most welcome. Good folks, we are in your able hands. Whoever is leading us with the presentation, you may kindly commence. Could you kindly switch on your mic?
Sorry, sir. Mr. Michael Hendricks, sir, who is in charge of voting, he's a senior manager in charge of voting, will do the presentation, sir.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Hendricks. Good morning, Chair and members. Thank you very much. We have distributed a hard copy of our presentation. We have distributed a hard copy, Chair, so I'll go through this. Just as by way of introduction, the Commission, as part of its debriefing sessions amongst its own staff as well as with the National Party Liaison Committee, reviews the legislation as well as our practices. And from those sessions, internally as well as externally, certain matters have been brought to light which we recommend there should be legislative changes for. This would be in terms of our official responsibilities to review legislation as well. Once we have done so, we have then made certain recommendations to the Minister of Home Affairs, and the bill is now before members via the Minister and Cabinet. Just by way of background, Chairperson, there are three real motivations for why we had to look at the provisions. The first one relates to facilitation of voting and making it increasing the opportunities for voters to vote and to vote in a manner that is accessible to them as well. For example, one of the matters we look at is as a chair with known members, are the queues that develop during voting and how we can best also deal with that. We then also look at the participation of political parties and how we can facilitate their participation while at the same time still looking after the integrity of the electoral process as a whole. And then lastly, from our own side, in terms of administering for our mandate, ensuring that we are in a position to better manage the elections. So those are the overall backgrounds in terms of where we come from. We have identified certain of the problem statements. And I'm not sure, Chair, how would you like to proceed? Do we go towards the clauses or deal it clause by clause, or how, Chair?
You have given us a broad overview. Now is to start from the beginning and go through the proposed changes, amendments, go through your table of contents from the beginning through every chapter, clause by clause, where you'd like to effect changes. Right. In that manner, you'll have everybody working with you. You have dealt more extensively with this process, as you said, at the multi-party level, but members have not had that opportunity. So let's just go through it.
Clause by clause?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Can I therefore refer members then to clause one of the draft bill? In essence, in the national elections, we have an election timetable that is in a pro forma prescribed in the Electoral Act. We don't have a similar pro forma electoral timetable in the Municipal Electoral Act. And all this provision is doing is to try and regularize the situation between the Electoral Act and the Municipal Electoral Act by having and providing for a pro forma a timetable, which is then clear to all parties and voters what are the steps in the electoral process. I don't know if there's comment on open. Okay. Thank you, Chair. The next provision relates to Section 14. Clause 2 relates to Section 14 of the Act. Section 14 deals with the participation nomination of PR or party list candidates by political parties that are contesting the election. What we're doing here is firstly, one, making sure that the list that we receive is from the authorized party representative. What we have found in the past is, notwithstanding arrangements with political parties, we still find, Chair, that a number of people come to us with different lists on behalf of the same party. That just makes administering the process so much more difficult. And we do not, we're just seeking to make that clear that it must be the authorized rep from the party. Secondly, when a party is formed, one of the conditions is that the party must comply with the code of conduct. What we're doing in this particular bill is we're just emphasizing that by making sure that the political party, again, when it's nominating its candidates, gives a written undertaking that the party, its executive, and its candidates will all comply to the code of conduct, the electoral code of conduct. So just making it very specific. This is also something that is already in the Electoral Act. Secondly, it's also a declaration by the political party that none of its candidates that it is proposing is in fact disqualified in terms of the Constitution or any national legislation. Again, it's similar to what is in the Electoral Act, and just making sure that parties don't put up candidates who are in fact not qualified in terms of the Constitution. Then, Chair, there was a specific request by the political parties. One of the documents that we require is a copy of the person's ID, the front page of the ID. Now, as it currently stands, that copy must be certified, and political parties said it's very difficult for them to always get hold of a member to give them a copy of their ID and then to still get it certified. And therefore, they requested that the requirement that the ID must be certified, that portion must just be removed. So in other words, they will still give us a copy of the first page of their ID, but that just doesn't need to be certified, and we are quite satisfied with that particular request from the political parties. And then the next particular step relates then to the when a party gives us their supporting documents. As I just said, attached to that must also be an acceptance of nomination by the candidate, as well as a copy of the ID. Now, sometimes it happens that they don't get it to us in time. There is a non-compliance period. So we issue a notice, and the party has a time to fix that up. And this, the provision in subclause C simply provides to make sure that there is a specific time and date by which they have to come back with those particular information. And then, Chair, it also then makes clear that if a party a candidate is not on the voter's roll of a particular municipality, he or she cannot be a candidate for that municipal council. Otherwise, you have a situation of people coming from out of town being, and it's in fact a requirement of the Constitution. So what we do here is just make it very clear, because as members would reflect, we try and make the Electoral Act and the Municipal Electoral Act a handbook for elections, so that the rules are very clear to anybody that reads it, so you remove the arbitrariness of it. So that particular is in that deals in with clause 2, Chair. Okay.
Thank you.
The next clause 3, relates to nomination of ward candidates. Now, you can either be a candidate for a party or for an independent. Now, firstly, this clarifies is that when an independent is standing in a ward, he or she must have the support of at least 50 voters from that particular ward. And this is just making sure that is clarified. It has always been a requirement, and this is just being clarified. Similarly, the requirement that the ID copy must be certified is being removed. And then similarly to what party candidates have to do, here again, for ward candidates, the candidate must undertake that they will be abiding by the code of conduct, and they will also make a declaration that they are not disqualified from standing in the particular election. And then previously, Chair, the opportunity to give us the outstanding documents, like the ID and acceptance, was limited to PR candidates and wasn't available to ward candidates. What the clause is now proposing is that even with regard to a ward candidate, if he hasn't given us his copy of ID on time, there will be a compliance period for that. It just makes it fairer between candidates, Chairperson. Clause 4, Chair. Central payments. At the request of political parties at the National Party Liaison Committee, parties that want to contest municipalities across the country requested us to make an opportunity available for them when they can make one payment at our national office to cover all the municipalities. There are some parties that contest each and every one. So instead of the party then having to go and have 237 checks issued, there's one check, they can pay it then at the national office. This was an arrangement in 2006. What Clause 17A now proposes is to regularize that by making sure that the arrangement is now can be performed in a particular prescribed manner. So that really is what it means is if you have a central payment, you can only do it at the national office of the IEC when you're contesting more than one municipality. Clause 5, Chairperson. At the moment, in the Electoral Act for national elections, there's a provision that says during the course of the day, depending on the situation that happens at a voting station, the presiding officer can, after consulting the party agents and the security officials, realign or move the boundaries of a particular voting station. There is no specific provision as that in the Municipal Electoral Act. And what Clause 5 does is to just make it very clear to party agents that this is a power which the presiding officer has, because it has led to disputes, because normally people say, where in the Act does it say that you can move or change a boundary? So this just makes it very clear for everybody.
In regard to that, is my understanding correct that at times you find that at voting stations, there's a certain time when voting has to end, and you find there are long queues, and there might be thousands of people who are outside the perimeter of the particular voting station, so that in that case, the officials, political parties would decide, in order to ensure that everybody who still needs to cast a vote, say that outside perhaps the fence of the school or whatever, up to a certain area, all people there, it covers that type of situation.
Exactly, Chair, thank you. Then we also have Clause 6. Just as a way of background to Clause 6, committee members would remember that in some voting stations, queues develop, and it's very difficult to manage these queues because as it currently stands, all these persons must go into one particular structure. Say, for example, at the school, you can only use that one classroom when in fact you have this whole school possibly available. And we found that in some areas, while we try and make sure that our voting districts are small enough to manage, in some of our areas, especially in densely populated urban areas, it's very difficult to draw a line within a settlement to start saying, okay, you in this voting district, or to split a particular committee. So what we're proposing is that there will be certain voting stations that we will classify as a voting center. It's still a station, but it will allow us then to be able to use three or four classrooms in a school. And then as people come in, you can divide them possibly alphabetically and say, okay, A to F is in room one, etc., etc. Now, because it's still a voting station, we don't need to change anything with regard to voting stations. The one implication, however, is relates to party agents, which this clause in 6 to assist, because at the moment you can only have two agents per party. Now, obviously, if you're using three or four classrooms, you can't, you know, your party is not going to be able to be in every classroom. So all this does is that in those cases where we're going to use voting centres, a party can have an agent in each one of those rooms. It's also not limited to a school. For example, where currently we use one tent, what this will allow us to do is put up three tents next to each other, so that you can also manage and have enough staff then, because in every voting or substation will have its own deputy, and the process will hopefully also be able to assist voters to vote quicker and let them spend less time. Clause
members, we are following.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 7. Firstly, assistance to voters. The voter requiring assistance due to physical disability. What we're adding here is including blindness or other visual impairment, because sometimes our presiding officers don't see blindness as a physical disability. So they then, it leads to a different or not uniform application of the law, because when a blind person arrives, that person is entitled to bring somebody with him to assist him or her. And sometimes some of presiding officers are not clear whether blindness is a physical disability or not. They see it as a person that cannot read and write. So all we're doing here is clarifying, Chairperson, that this is the situation. And then secondly, what we also had in the past is that a presiding officer could assist a person who cannot read and write in the presence of two party agents. It didn't explicitly allow the presiding officer to, for example, assist a blind person. So if the blind person doesn't arrive with an assistant, the presiding officer still assisted, but then you'd have agents saying, yeah, but you can't specifically assist, but we still assisted them. So this particular provision just makes it clear that even in the case of a person with a physical disability, the presiding officer can also assist, as long as that assistance is in the presence of at least, or at most, two party agents.
Honourable Masizo.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the current Principal Act as it stands, Section 48B and C, 48B and read together with C, to me it does satisfy, especially those who are sitting at the voting station as party agents, that look, if you come in and the presiding officer says you must bring a person that is at least at the voting age, which is 18 and above, so the person under normal circumstances will be bringing a person that they trust. Now, there's been questions. I'm actually outraged to see that political parties have agreed to the current amendment. I must say to you, it has not helped in many cases. There would be streaming complaints. I think Dr. Pam will agree to it. During elections, I, for one, have been complaining, even after the elections last year, that presiding officers in many cases would find themselves being dragged into an attempt of being aligned in that situation during the election, wanting to support party A or B for whatever reasons. Now, if a presiding officer then is the person who, if and when he is asked to assist, then may assist the voter directly, I'm telling you, this is going to create problems immediately when we implement it.
So the current amendment makes it very easy for those presiding officers who are unscrupulous, coming with some kind of intentional processes that will completely confuse the situation. So I would suggest that this is the beginning of the process here, but we ought to be looking at this situation very seriously. I don't think the amendment is helping the situation. What I would suggest, though, is that the presiding office, the person must actually be assisted as the current act stands, and then the presiding officer must just monitor that the process is done fairly, and that section 47 is not, and it still stands in terms of the municipal electoral act. Otherwise, the secrecy of the vote will somehow be jeopardized. But I don't think the amendment is helping. I don't think I need to stress it further, Chair. But it's going to create many problems, unless they want to convince me otherwise.
Honorable Member, thank you. I'm not sure if there are inputs from other members, but I'd also advise members, you must also go and consult with your parties what they've agreed at this multi-party level with the IEC, so that as we move forward, it's our responsibility to flag any issues. But the point, at least, that I got clear here is that there's been petitions from the disability sector where they say, as is drafted here, that if a person can't see, it does not necessarily mean they can't read or write. So they should be able to come with a person to say that this person will give expression to my intention. The other issue, I'm sure the IEC will also comment, but we should also mitigate a situation. We can't say that all IEC officials on the day, they come with their preconceived notions and they'll be corrupt, they'll be doing this. I would just caution that we are careful there, you see. We are prejudging people. From my experience in the past, without fear or favor, where party agents have been remiss, not party agents, IEC officials have been remiss in carrying out their functions, the IEC has acted to such an extent in KZN, there are people who are in prison today as a result of that activity. So I'm just saying that let us discuss possible questions, but let us be careful how we do so without just casting blanket aspersions. Members, delegation from the IEC, if you'd like to engage this particular point, kindly do so. Thank you, ma'am.
I wanted, through you, sir, to ask him what you think would be best. If somebody comes, an older person, in some cases is escorted by umzukulwana, a grandchild who is not 18. That's sometimes the problem we have, because 18-year-olds and above are not there. What would satisfy the political parties? Because we can't ask anybody around a voting station to help this person. The person within the law, according to this, notwithstanding the problem of impartiality, is a presiding officer, and that's why. This has been a problem, and we're trying to find a way that will meet quite seriously people's needs. I'm afraid this is a common practice in other countries, and I'm not suggesting that we are worse off than other countries, but the presiding officer, unfortunately, will always belong to one party or another. We have to deal with that. And what we are faced with is the integrity of the person. For all of us in the process, it's really our own integrity, at which point a person feels responsible enough not to exploit a person because a person cannot read and write. It's your own conscience that you don't try and so that really is a challenge to us. I'm just putting it as some idea that you think might be said. We dare not ask party agents when they're sitting there because they're representing their parties, and that's the first problem. And we can't ask any other staff person who is there. So in terms of our law, then there's one authority. I don't want to labor the point, but I'm already doing so anyway.
Sir?
To refer to the section which requires the presiding officer, when he does render this assistance, that he must do so. I'm sorry, sir. That if you look at the section, the presiding officer, if he does render such assistance, he must do so in the presence of two different parties, two agents from different parties, and if they are observers, in the presence of an observer as well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Honourable Member?
Chairperson, the challenge which I do have is in no way trying to put a blanket on the presiding officers in general. I think those are individuals, those are people, and they can be judged on individual basis. But based on the experiences, obviously somewhere there may have been some very good experiences, but in other places, I must tell you, there's been bad to worse experiences in terms of the impartiality of those who are tasked with the duties of being presiding officers. Now, in this case, it does bring me to a position of obviously consulting with those reps that we've sent to the IEC. So that when I get the next earliest convenience, then I can actually make some suggestions which are better. But as I've said, I'm actually having serious reservations in terms of the current amendment, which may give too much powers, and even forget the section that Dr. van der Merwe referred to, the one of saying that in terms of subsection 2B, that those two agents may then come and play some oversight. So in the event where you have more than two parties, you'll end up having those people fighting among themselves, saying, no, I want to see. And the other one says, no, I also want to go and see. Remember, in a very hotly closely contested election, it's always a situation like that. But I guess there's room to look at this further. I wouldn't like to give a suggestion now, Dr. Bao, but rather to take it and see it further. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Member. Member Winya, are you fine? Okay, thank you, ma'am. We may proceed, Mr. Hendricks.
Thank you, Chair. The next clause, Clause 8, deals with special voting. As members would know, previously special voting was not allowed in terms of the Municipal Electoral Act. We do have special voting during national elections. What this particular provision seeks then is to provide that any person who is unable to vote on voting day at his voting station can do so on a day prior to the actual election day, as long as that person, however, must still be voting in his or her voting district. We cannot have a situation where we allow a special vote, but you vote outside. Because, as you know, with local government elections, it's a ward-based. So you're not going to have the ward ballots for every municipality and ward available at all the stations. And you know the special vote that will take place will be on a day before the election. As it currently stands, the provision makes two types of special votes. Firstly, one would be a person that simply cannot get to the voting
on voting day, for whatever reason. We're not putting a particular reason down. So for whatever reason, Chair, that you cannot be there on, say, for example, the Wednesday, you can vote on the Tuesday, as long as you then apply for such a special vote. And the second category, obviously, would be a person that is, due to their physical condition, cannot get to the station at all. In other words, you then apply for a home visit in your voting district where you are limited to your house. You know, the bedridden person that cannot get out of his or her house to the station. So that is really what in a nutshell, the special vote provision relates to, Chairperson. So it's in effect, what it's doing, it's changing completely Section 55 because it wasn't allowed. Now we allow, we're proposing that we go ahead with special voting.
Ma'am? Yeah.
It's on the process of application. Not everybody's familiar. Where you apply, when do you do the application, and just the process, because it will be the first time we're doing this.
Perhaps also before you begin, I would think that what you are seeking to also remedy here, there are people who are on duty like the police, and I just had a little bit of concern where you say that anybody can apply. I could understand the police, the sick, the lame, but when we cast the net so wide and say anybody, I also think about the lazy. So you'll have to address the what, how do we mitigate that situation?
Chief, so can I first start with your issue about what appears to be casting the net too wide. Whenever, Chair, we tend to set categories, the difficulty is to how do you include everybody? As you make the point, Chair, the security officials on duty, electoral staff that are actually working the next day, they can vote the day before. But then you start looking at essential services and you say, okay, yes, essential services. And then you start getting a request from the Truck Drivers Union of South Africa that says, but we are driving. And then you get, you know, you as soon as we set certain categories, you forever the Commission will be dealing with additional requests, which are very valid. And it can be for a number of reasons that a person cannot be. And really that is why what we're proposing is not a situation where of 2 days of voting. It's still a special vote. It is still a process of applying for that particular vote. And coming to what then the Chair said is that what we seek is because, you know, the local government by its very nature and it involves wards, PR for the local, PR for the DC, we need to make sure that our logistics is in place. And therefore, what in terms of special vote, you will have to apply before the time so that we can make the arrangements. It's no use just, you know, on the day, on the Monday, saying, I want a home visit. And we will not have the staff or the logistic arrangement cars available to just to do home visits as and when somebody just does it. So primarily what will happen, we are still finalizing the actual modalities around it, but there will be a time, say for example, at least a week before the actual election day in which you must apply to the IEC and say, look, I'm applying for a so it also will prevent somebody simply, say if we're having the voting on the Tuesday at the station as a special vote, it will also then prevent anybody, the lazy person, of just walking in there and saying, I want a vote. You had to previously actually apply for, so they may deal with those situations. At the same time, we would be able to then deal with a real or genuine case of a person, whether it's work or other family commitment, just cannot be on voting day.
Thank you. You have dealt with the lazy.
Sorry, Chair. Okay. The Chair says, I must just clarify more. What you will do is you will then apply before the time at the office of the local office of the IEC. When you apply, you will apply in person or you will send your proxy. In the case, obviously, of somebody that's bedridden, she or he cannot arrive and apply himself, so you can send somebody with. And then when you make the application at the office, immediately our staff is able to look on the voter's roll, confirm that yes, you are in fact in that voting district, and then inform you that yes, we will come and visit you, or yes, you can come and the voting station is at that particular location. So the pre-notification will also deal with informing you whether you were successful or not. Say, for example, somebody comes and says, I want a thing, and we say, sorry, but that is not your voting district. Did you know you're actually there, you know, at a different place where you actually registered? And also so be able to assist the individual, but it will then be at least, because we have to, in a case of home visits, we have to at least know that there are going to be 20 home visits, therefore we need X number of staff with on a route that will be able to make sure that we can then get to the people that need to be home visited as well on a particular day. The home visits may then take place on the Monday, so as we can deal with all the home visits, and on the Tuesday, the voting station opens to deal with all those people that can get to the station, but not on the Wednesday, so that you can also minimize the rush, or the, you know, and we can have the staff arrangements.
Thank you, sir. Laat ons reg die son drink water.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Now we come to clause 9, determination and declaration of...
Just a second, there's a member who had a hand up very late. It's like the linesman who raises the flag after the goal has been scored. Ma'am Aduna Peterson, your opportunity.
Thank you, Chairperson. Before we pass, I just wanted to ask for the home visits. Will there be enough cars? Because I remember the last time IEC had no enough cars. There was a problem concerning different parties. I just needed clarity. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Member, it's exactly because we wanted to make sure that there's a particular time by which you apply, so that we can put those logistic arrangements in place, so that our officials can actually go and visit these home visits. It will also be, we will also then be able to give the local party liaison committee a list and say, look here, these are the people that have applied and who we are going to visit. So that the party can also make their own arrangements in terms of being, because they are obviously entitled to observe that home visit process as well. So the idea is that you can also better inform the local party reps that this is the actual places we are visiting and etc.
Thank you.
Clause 9, Chair. What this provides for is a situation where if the Commission, for whatever reason, and it would be an exceptional reason, cannot declare a particular result within the 7 days as prescribed in the Commission Act, the Commission can then apply to the Electoral Court for such condemnation. This particular provision currently exists in the Electoral Act for the National Assembly and Provincial, but it doesn't exist for local government. And it's not something we've used in the past, but in the event that we cannot keep, for example, Chair, if we have provisions that relate to, for example, revoting, if ballot papers or whatever is destroyed before counting starts, and we have to have a revote, and we can only do that 4 days later or whatever, that will then obviously impact in terms of this overall 7 day period. Or if, for example, voting at a station had to be postponed because of flooding, and we have to postpone it by a week, which obviously that week would be 7 days. Now, according to the proclamation, election is on the 1st, and by the 7th we have to. Now, for whatever reason, we can't. So it's a very good, it's not something that the Commission will then go nilly-willy to the court and say, oh, we can't do it, because we obviously know how important it is that elections are declared as soon as possible. And our record shows also, Chair, that we generally do it within 3 days. So it's really just to cover for the very exceptional situation that may arise.
Thank you.
Clause 10, Chair, deals with a substitution of the current Section 65. Now, Section 65 is meant to deal with objections which are material to the result. In other words, the objection is such that if it is upheld, it affects the result of the election. So it's a major objection. It is not lodged at the station. It is, however, lodged directly with the Commission. And when I say the Commission, I'm talking about our Commission as the five members of the board of the Commission. Now, in the past, what this provision simply said is that somebody can object to any aspect of the election. Now, that is very broad. And what we seek to do is to limit the objection to areas where we at least have some measure of control over. All right, so it will relate to the voting, to counting, as well as it's stated here, anything that happened in the immediate vicinity of the voting station. Because the current provision is so broad that if somebody is unhappy with not being a candidate for your party, they can, after the election, come to us and make an objection and say, it's material because obviously if I was a candidate, it would have obviously changed it. And that for us goes beyond what we as IEC should be doing, because it's something that now you are actually getting involved in the party's processes, and a political party shouldn't be determining political party's candidates. And that is why it is so broad that that we feel that it needs to be limited to areas where we are have some measure of impact. So if it relates to voting, counting, the results, anything that happened immediately outside, say for example, there was this massive intimidation just outside the station boundaries, it will affect the result, and that is still included in the provision. So that is the first part. The second part also relates then to is how the commission will go about dealing with these particular matters. As I indicated, Chairperson, that there are only five commissioners that when this objection comes with, and they have to then deal with. Now, what this law allows is that the commission can actually then cause it to be investigated by appointing the specific persons to assist the commission to actually investigate a particular matter, because they just may not get to all the particular issues as and when it happens. And then lastly, Chair, it also then makes it very clear that the setting aside of an election as a whole cannot be done by the commission itself. Rather, it should be done by the electoral court, because of the impact of it, and because we are actually managing the process as well. And so this is what the bill, the clause specifically allows for. In cases, for example, where the commission themselves, having considered a objection, feel that may lead to the setting aside of an election, it can make that application into the electoral court as well. And the electoral court, who's then sitting as the judiciary, can then make that call as to whether, in fact, this election must be set aside or not, or amend the result, etc., or make an appropriate order in the particular circumstances.
Thank you. Are you still with me, members? I greatly appreciate that. I would hate to be going alone. Honorable member.
It's a matter of clarity. Now, say I come and object, the current provisions makes it possible that I may object and still be given time and the right to hear the outcome of that objection. Now, what does the current amendment does in terms of that, except to say that the IEC may decide to refer or to you know, on the turnaround times, because it actually restricts you now that you must do it within 3 days, unless the matter is going to court for an appeal. Now, if you could clarify it further, does it still empower the person that needs to appeal for that decision, for the decision to still be heard within the time that is required?
Could you switch off your mic? Thank you.
Yes, Chair. Enjoy. Thank you. The rights of the objector is still there, that you have the right to make an objection. The commission, in investigating the particular matter, can call for further written information from the objector. It can also have a hearing where obviously the objector will attend to. In a number of electoral court decisions, the court has indicated that the current provision that says the commission must deal with an objection within 3 days is vastly impractical. By its very nature, some of these involve actually having a hearing. If it's a straightforward thing of involving a mechanical mistake of you counted wrong, that's fine. But if it involves the commission actually holding a hearing, etc., it's impossible to keep to the actual 3 days. So what this also then provides is that you must understand the difference between with the national elections, we are not allowed to declare the result unless all objections have been dealt with. That's in the national and provincial elections. In this particular case, the fact that the election, what you're actually objecting to is the declared result. You know, the result has now been declared. It doesn't mean that you cannot, as long as you object still within the 3 days from the election date. Even if that election result, the ward winner has been declared already. As long as, it, you know, say for example, the elections is Wednesday. Thursday, the ward election is out and we said who's the ward councillor. And by Friday morning, you found something that is so egregious that affects the election result. You can still make an objection. And the commission can still make its decision with regard to that particular matter. So it looks at that particular situation. So you as an objector are not actually worse off than what previously was the case. It just makes it for easier, better management of this process.
Michael, can you go again and just start on the definition of an objection as different from a complaint? Sometimes the parties confuse a complaint and an objection. That's the first thing, except for the people in law know the difference, we don't. The second thing, Michael, that might help. What are those things specifically? I think it might help that people would go to the electoral court for, rather than expect the IEC to resolve. That might just help to just give concrete examples of the kind of things that at a voting station we'll say, if we have counted wrongly, as Michael has given the example, then we have to take the responsibility. What else do we do wrongly at voting stations, Michael? You did say something else, because I think that might help a little bit, if you can think of something. If you can just think of the case itself and you begin to identify the case that gave us trouble on this, that might be a better example for you. Because that's how this came about. We had a particular difficult case, hence we felt it was necessary that these changes are made. We make an amendment because of a particular case we realized that we were not able to handle here.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Well, firstly, just the difference between an objection and a complaint. A complaint is what we'll normally handle if you pick up the phone and you say, look, I'm not happy with something going somewhere. If you want to escalate it, then you can then escalate it into a formal objection. So the complaint is something which is normally dealt with, whether it's through the PLC, you know, or calling the local office and they deal with the matter. An objection is where the law provides for a specific procedure. For example, during voting, you can object to the presiding officer if you believe somebody shouldn't be voting. You know, it's not the person that you know, there's a fraud or whatever. Or during the counting process, when you want to have a recount, you have to object then and there. And then subsequent to the election, obviously, you have this. So that is really the difference. We have what we call the issue tracker, where people call in complaints about, they say, you know, the presiding officer was rude or whatever, and we deal with that particular in that manner. But there are those that you want to obviously make into a formal objection, and that's really the difference between how we manage objections and complaints. Now, in regard to what the chairperson was talking about, the specific case related to where there were incidents of intimidation outside the station that led to the fact that, and it was then confirmed by our own staff as well as the security officials, where voters were physically being stopped from actually entering the voting station. Now, that is a very serious allegation, and then the commission had to investigate it. But now the problem is, the commission cannot set aside the election, and how do you then deal with that particular matter? And it's not clear the power of the commission to refer something to the electoral court always. And what we're trying to do here is to exactly make that very clear what is going to be the process. If the commission feels that, listen, this is something we'll deal with, or this is so egregious that it in fact may lead to the setting aside, let the electoral court make that particular decision about that.
You may add, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Just a small point that I need to add. There is another advantage to any interested party that may want to object. In terms of the current Act, they may only object after the results are declared. But in terms of the amendment, they will have an opportunity to object even before the results are declared or after the results are declared. So you'll see that in subsection 6 and subsection 7 deals with situations before and situations after the results have been declared. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for that material point. I've learned the hard way in my little experience chairing meetings. Whenever somebody says, I've just got a small point to make, most of the time it's never small. So today is no exception either. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And then the last clause, members will remember that we started off by saying that we want a pro forma timetable. What this last clause is then the insertion of a schedule to our Municipal Electoral Act that then is the timetable. It will say on this date these things must happen. It just makes it very clear and at a particular time. And when the timetable says you must do something, it will always be 5 o'clock. And as my CEO always says, it's 5 o'clock on her watch and nobody else's watch. So it just makes that also very clear because we have to regulate the election, and as you'll see that there's so many things that need to happen leading up from nomination to that you need to have a timeline, otherwise the process just can become out of control. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir. We are moving, members. Let's proceed. Please make your point.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was asked to just also refer the committee to the memorandum, the explanatory memorandum to item 4, where it says that there are no financial implications for the state.
What page are you reading?
In the page 10, Chairperson. Item 4, there are no, it says there that there are no financial implications for the state. But the truth of the matter is that if Parliament does agree that there can be special votes, it would mean an increase in the expenditure of over 100 million rand. And we will have to go to the Treasury to ask them to give us that money. So there are financial implications. Thank you, sir.
So you are pointing us that point number 10 should actually be corrected, where it says that there are no financial implications.
Number four, rather.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Chairperson.
Go back to clause 8 a little bit that was dealing with special votes. I'm just making a comment, sir. I'm not making a comment that is of a legal nature. My comment I'm making is not the change of law, but simple to say to you, sir, this is going to be the greatest challenge to us. To have special, I just want the members to know, sir, to have special votes for people, and I think for urban areas probably we'll manage it because the distances in urban areas are reasonable, the travel is reasonable, and so the home visits that he was talking about will probably be possible in a township, even a huge township like Alexandra Township or Soweto, but that's big. It's easily said than done, sir. The crisis we have is that we have many rural areas in South Africa. Many, many, especially in the Eastern Cape, in Limpopo, KwaZulu-Natal. And what we're saying, to do a home visit, 4x4, you have to find, for people to find our offices to do an application, is quite a challenge because staff members cannot go to one, some area I'm thinking of. You have 65 villages. I'm just giving it as an example. Now, how does a staff member, staff members, how many are we going to have to do home visits to reach those homes for people who need special votes? That is not, it's easy to say we can hire cars. It means how many 4x4s we'll hire to do those home visits that we're talking about. And for people to find our offices are not near every home. Some people have to travel, take taxis to get to our office. We don't have an office at every area, even for people who go to voting stations. And so this special vote of going to a home, those who can apply will be lucky to apply on time for the CO to receive applications. We are talking of applications that are coming to all over our country in the 9 provinces. And so I'm simply making a comment, say that it's going to be a challenge. It's the first time we are doing it. I'm not surprised that it has such heavy financial implications. But even if we bought everybody a 4x4 and make sure that they do the application to the CO before the day, that's an area of challenge. I think where the people, I don't think people are lazy. I don't know. I think what some people might do is what they did to us, say, which I would like to share with you, if you permit me, where we said for presidential election, people can go and vote. Oh, Goziam, Chair, people were all over the place. They go to a place, they call friends because they've heard that such and such a station, the lines are short. So they drive there, and the political parties drive them. They put people in a kumbi, and they drive them to that voting station because somebody told them that the lines there are better. And then they make the lines there very, very long because the word went round that such a school. and that's why you heard stories in the press that we ran out of ballot papers. We didn't run out of ballot papers. You know, we had printed the right papers, we had the extras, but it was because people took advantage of this provision and were all over the place. And then there were some instances where people took people for special voting and somebody says, oh, now you can vote since you are here. Why don't you vote with these people who are here? But that's another story. I'm simply recording for you to know that this is probably the greatest challenge for us.
Chairperson, if I understand you correctly, you are saying that democracy is expensive, but the principle that we seek to address here is to avail the opportunity under the most practical situation to all that we can. But unfortunately, some, because of logistical, practical, financial reasons, might still fall out of the net, outside the net, when people go and seek to address this issue. So we'll still have notification, even after the elections, that certain people were not visited. So it might not be out of a wanton situation, but due to the practicalities that you have outlined. So we'll be mindful of those areas of concern. But what we are clear about is that the current legal provisions that we are seeking to draft seek to mitigate the situations that have been outlined. Mr. Hendricks, we are in your hands.
I've completed my portion, Chairperson. I don't know if my commissioners want to add anything.
Honourable members, your opportunity again for comment, questions. Dinyel Akbar Masizole.
Oh, Chair, I won't be brief today, this time around, otherwise I will take forever. I think the main issues that have been flagged, sorry, they too indeed somehow assist the process of ensuring that voting is as quick, as swift, as transparent, and as more democratic as possible. The the one issue which I would like to flag going further is the issue of centralizing the payments for parties contesting elections, which is clause 4. That one is very, very interesting in ensuring that we try and mitigate the factors that make it very difficult for political parties. You can imagine if you are contesting 100 votes in Cape Town, for instance, 105 votes as the previous demarcation allowed, then you will have to go to all those offices in those areas to pay for the election. In fact, the current provision, Chair, to be precise, is that if you have certain number of municipalities in a province, you must go to all those municipalities and pay if you want to contest elections. Now, this current one makes it very easier for us so that you are then able to go to all these offices, to one center and deposit money. So I think that is a very good progressive stand that you have taken, because the original statute as it stands is such that many political parties are deprived of an opportunity to contest elections fairly in a democratic dispensation. But one thing which I want to ask from the IEC, Dr. Pam, you just mentioned that Section 24A made it very difficult for you, those forms that you will have to fill in when they go to those voting stations. But it was the national election. Now, is there any way that you think that could be dealt with? Are you going to make another suggestion for amendment? Because this one, Chair, is not dealing with that. It simply deals with the municipal elections. I must say it was very difficult in many cases. I know I have a situation in an election, the previous election in Khayelitsha, where I've raised it immediately in our first meeting when we met last year with the IEC, that we would find a station, you are told that there's no ballot papers, we are waiting for them, and only to establish later that no, IEC did not have less ballot papers, but it's just that in a particular station, many people tend to flock to flock into that station for one reason or the other. Now, are you going to bring an amendment to Parliament, a suggestion for us to look at those amendments? I'm not sure what is going to happen, especially for 2014.
I think you answer that. Fortunately, I won't be here for 2014. CEO, can you answer that for the future, how you see that?
Morning, Chairperson and honorable members. Let me apologize for coming late. My flight was delayed.
You are welcome. When you say your flight was delayed, I remember a friend of mine saying that the plane left me. And I said to him, my dear friend, the plane didn't leave you. You arrived late at the airport. There's a material difference there. But welcome.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, I didn't arrive late. I was missed in Johannesburg, so we could not take off. Section 24 is quite a challenge. Obviously, it doesn't apply for local government elections, because in local government elections, people are supposed to vote where they are registered and register where they live. We having discussions among ourselves as the Commission whether we should retain Section 24A or not. In fact, for the 2009 elections, there was a view that said that we should probably repeal it, make recommendations to Parliament to repeal it. But most of the political parties sitting on the National Party Liaison Committee did not agree with a view that said we should repeal it, so we left it. But of course, we've learned some lessons in 2009, and we have to, going forward in 2014, say whether we're going to retain it or modify it in a way that it will not create the kind of chaos that it created in 2009. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Any other comments from members, questions? I must also say that I'm not sure, perhaps I should schedule more meetings on a Friday. Today the portfolio committee is in luck. I'm saying in luck because I see the parliamentary legal advisor, I see the state law advisor, and there's also the department's legal eagles. So perhaps Friday is a good day because I did hear the cry from the parliamentary legal advisor and state law advisor that there are very few of them, about six or seven, and we have more than close to 50 portfolio and select committees. But just to say welcome, I'm happy to see you. Long lost friends, welcome. Members, Memawunye, you seem to be wanting to share your sweet voice with us. You may do so.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think the amendment will assist in the process of the local government elections. And I wanted to propose that since we are having our elections next year, if we could swiftly or prioritize to deal with this local government bill so that people, the IEC could make the necessary preparations timelessly. And also that, well, other things we will see as time goes on. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Member, I must just say that whilst we are dealing as expeditiously as we can with the births, deaths, amendment bill, and also the citizenship amendment bill, but we are giving priority to this one, Chairperson, because of the time constraints and urgency of the matter. So if we all work closely together, we should be able to meet the necessary timelines so that we can pass over to the NCOP, the upper house, so that they can deliberate on the issues that we would have dealt with. I'm told there's a magic timeline that pushes us close to 17th of September or something. So we'll try our best whilst doing justice to the work in front of us. But it will also help all of us if we can also be in close liaison and discussion with our respective political parties so that when we come here, we are able to engage the issues with the full knowledge that everybody have consulted their principles. But when we are here, the primary objective obviously is to formulate and frame the best possible legislation in the interests of our country. So that mandate remains the primary one. So we'll seek to do our best to carry out that particular mandate. I'm not sure, parliamentary legal advisor, state law advisor, if you'll want to say anything, at least to justify your presence here and justify your pay for the day or the month. I give you that opportunity. I start with the parliamentary legal advisor.
Chair, at this stage, I do not have anything to say. I did have another meeting to go to, but I prioritized the bill.
Thank you. In legal jargon, you say you concur. I go to the next one, state law advisor.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to say that we look at the bill, the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor, and we certify the bill. So we concur with the bill that it complies with the constitution and is drafted in the manner that conforms with the legislative practice. Thank you, Chairperson.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I must say I saw you partaking of my humble coffee and tea, so you can't accuse me of wasteful and fruitless expenditure. Good folks, if there are no further comments from members, the next time we meet, we'll seek to finalize on this particular bill so that we can get it to the National Council of Provinces at the earliest opportunity. Madam Chairperson.
I see we have a bit of time. Just to share with you the good news that the Demarcation Board, which is responsible in this country for the boundaries and the wards, have submitted to us on the 1st of September all the new wards of South Africa. So we are very delighted. We'll be able to move. There has been a big increase in the number of wards. An increase, as they told us, of 10%. I don't know what 10% works out to. 382 more. And now what is the total number of the wards? I don't have my... 4277. 4277. It's a healthy sign, sir, that multipartism is really entrenching itself seriously, the enthusiasm of participation, and I think these elections are going to be, local government elections are going to be something we haven't seen before. I think the parties are going to be very busy, because when you have so many wards, it means there's a hope for political parties that somebody at least is going to be a councillor. You see, there are incentives on these things, so hence there is all this enthusiasm. So we thought we should share that with you. We were a bit anxious that we might not be able to do that quickly. We are, of course, anxiously waiting, I need to say, about some decisions on some difficult areas we have. There's an area called Mutse, which is in the Limpopo. It's contested. That has not been resolved yet. We are waiting for the appropriate authorities to make decisions on that. We are hoping that the decision will be made soon so that we can do the necessary preparations in those areas too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just need to remind the House or any interested stakeholders, the bill that's in front of us today, we'll be having public hearings on it on the 14th of September. So that's when we'll take input from stakeholders, the public, just to hear what they have to say. The department's legal advisors, members, the other day we said that if we deal with the business of this particular electoral bill expeditiously, we might have time to discuss or conclude on the births, deaths, amendment bill. I'm not sure if you came ready for that. If not, then we'll take it to the next meeting. I'm in your able hands, gentlemen. There are many gentlemen here. Seems in the legal fraternity we'll have to speak to the law schools. We need to see more females as well. There's a gender imbalance amongst the legal eagles. We're in your able hands, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honourable members. Yes, well, we, as requested at the previous meeting that we had, we've gone and we're busy with finalising or setting up the document that deals with all the sections and the comments, etc. So we'll be dealing with both the SA Citizenship Amendment Bill and the Births and Deaths Registration Amendment Bill on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, in order to try and speed up the process as requested by the Portfolio Committee. Chair, thanks.
Thank you very much, Advocate. That being the case, good folks, I wouldn't like to detain you further here. I enjoy your company, but it's Friday. Meeting is adjourned. Go well.